It's another JR Morning with Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds on 760 WJR and streaming on WJR.com, where Michigan comes to talk. Filling in today for Chris Renwick, here's Republican strategist Jason Rowe.
Good morning. It is JR Morning. My co-host this morning, Jason Rowe. Jason, good to see you, buddy.
Top of the morning.
Tell you, this early for you?
No, I'm a morning person. I'm up at 4 a.m. no matter what.
Okay.
I just had to shower a little earlier today.
Okay. Man, the last time you were in the Fisher Building, it was probably, how long has that been?
45 years. I think was here with my mom and some friends to see Little Orphan Annie.
Down at the
theater?
Back in
like 1980.
Wow. Yep. Well, it's good to have you here.
No,
and before we get into the really big story today, I got to say those Pistons. I mean, you know, I just figure if we can get one in Cleveland, we're good. And so we lost one, and we had won five straight games. Okay, you know, and Cleveland plays hard at home. They haven't lost during the playoffs. So I think tonight, you know, we should be okay.
I feel good. I mean, the way we got slapped around in the first couple games against Orlando and how we responded, I mean, to rip off three straight games the way we did, the way Cade stepped up, and Durant even towards the end. But as you and I were talking before, I don't know why Paul Reed isn't playing
in every single game.
And when you see the bench come in, when you see, I mean, look who played the other night. Caris LeVert showed up. Ron Holland. Jenkins. I mean, when our bench is on the floor, we do good things. And so I don't know. Those first few games, the thing that was different than the regular season is we just left our starters in for most of the game.
Yeah.
But we got the talent, and I like Tassar Thompson's comments after the loss the other night about confidence, and he goes, we never lose our confidence. What are you talking
about?
And
you can tell. Yeah. No, they've been consistent throughout the regular season, and, you know, being down 3-1 and coming back, you know their confidence is pretty tight. James Harden woke up. I don't, you know, he was sleeping for a while.
Getting publicly ripped like he has. And, I mean, listen, he's had a great career, but, you know, how many years he's been in the playoffs and he's never gotten a ring? He's just getting dogged. And he's, you know, probably near the end of his career. I can't imagine he's got more than 2 or 3 years left.
I agree.
But, yeah, it's time for him to show up. But I don't want him to show up against the Pistons.
Nope. And not tonight. So we'll be looking forward to that Pistons game four tonight on NBC, 8 o'clock. So everybody make sure you're watching. This major water main break causing emergency conditions across parts of Oakland County after this critical failure early Sunday morning. The Great Lakes Water Authority says residents in Orion Township, the village of Lake Orion, Rochester Hills, and Northern Auburn Hills should only use water for essential needs like drinking, cooking, and basic sanitation. Officials in Orion Township have declared a state of emergency and issued a boil water advisory warning the outage could last up to 2 weeks as repairs are made. The break happened on a 42-inch transmission line in Riverwoods Park in Auburn Hills, forcing crews to isolate the system and begin emergency response efforts. Officials are urging residents to conserve water immediately while distribution sites have been set up to provide bottled water. Schools in Lake Orion will be closed today and tomorrow as the situation continues. Also, the massive water main break is causing major disruptions this morning, stretching from residential kitchens to the headquarters of one of the world's largest automakers. Following a state of emergency declaration in Auburn Hills, Stellantis has ordered the majority of its workforce to stay home today. Employees at the Chrysler Tech Center and several surrounding facilities are instructed to work remotely while the city grapples with the mandatory boil water advisory. Residents in Orion Township, Lake Orion, Rochester Hills, Northern Auburn Hills also urged to limit water use strictly to essential hydration and sanitation. Stellantis officials say essential staff remaining on site will be provided with bottled water. Other employees should monitor the company intranet for updates when it's safe to return. From what I understand, this water main had been in since, I think, 75. It should have lasted 100 years. It didn't. And they're working right now. I mean, they've been working 24/7. The lights are on. They're working in the dark. They're trying to get this back up.
Well, as I listen to you go over that, it occurred to me how angry these Stellantis employees are to go back to the office 5 days a week, and all of a sudden they're filing these complaints about how bad the conditions are in the building. I wonder if they didn't sabotage
it. You know, who knows? Yeah. That the rupture also has triggered a wave of school closings and operational shifts across the region. Lake Orion Community Schools remain closed today and Tuesday. Avondale School District and Crown of Life Preschool have canceled all classes today. Impact also hitting higher education. Oakland Community College has shifted its Auburn Hills campus to remote learning until further notice. Local officials warned that because of the scale of the damage, repairs could take weeks, and residents and parents are encouraged to check for further updates in your particular school districts. President Trump is escalating his rhetoric after Iran responded to a new U.S. proposal aimed at ending the war, calling Tehran's reply totally unacceptable in a post on Truth Social. The statement came just hours after Iranian officials through Pakistani mediation confirmed that they had delivered a response to the peace plan amid renewed tensions near the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump accused Iran of playing games with the United States while warning that its leadership would no longer be laughing at American efforts. The diplomatic back and forth comes as clashes continue in the region, including U.S. strikes on Iranian-linked tankers and ongoing concerns over disruptions to global shipping routes. Meanwhile, U.S. officials say negotiations are continuing behind the scenes with hopes of de-escalation and a potential agreement still on the table, though no breakthrough appears imminent. Jay, what do you think on that?
Well, I was told the war was going to end about 2 months ago, so I don't know why we're still in this position. But it's been frustrating because, one, I don't understand why the ceasefire ever took place. We should have finished the job once we started it. Why we think we can negotiate with the Iranians, that they are, you know, honest actors, I think is kind of foolish. So it is frustrating to see this continue to go on. And I think at this point, we got to deliver maximum pressure on Iran and force them basically to concede this thing, because what we've been doing just isn't working. And it's affecting every American, gas prices and the inflation that comes from gas prices, plus the fact that we find ourselves, you know, involved in a foreign conflict that we were promised we wouldn't be involved in the 2024 election.
And it appears that the president really doesn't want to go back to the military thing. He wants to really get a peace deal done. But you know who you're dealing with, and sometimes you can, you know, you have to, you can show them better than you can tell them.
Well, and I mean, think about how brilliantly the first 2 weeks went. I mean, we decapitated the senior leadership, including the Ayatollah, right out of the gate.
Yeah.
And then we took out the second Ayatollah, or at least disabled him. So he hasn't even been visible since those strikes. And so I thought those first 2 weeks, not only were militarily successful, but we showed the world what we were capable of. I mean, the videos of those planes in combat, were better than anything you'd see in Top Gun.
Yeah.
And I think it was a flex around the world that the U.S. military is the most dominant military there is. I think it was a flex on China, on Russia. But now we find ourselves just dragged in this quagmire trying to get out of this mess. And, you know, for Republicans facing election and re-election in November, if we don't get it resolved quickly, it's going to be trouble.
A large-scale evacuation underway after a hantavirus outbreak aboard a cruise ship, which docked in Spain. Spanish officials, health officials say 94 passengers from 19 nationalities were safely evacuated on the first day of operations, with travelers ferried ashore in small boats before being transported to airports for repatriation. The ship arrived carrying 147 people after three deaths were linked to the rare virus during its voyage from Argentina. Health officials stressed the risk to the public remains low, with the World Health Organization noting the situation is not comparable to COVID-19. Passengers are being sent to multiple countries for monitoring and treatment, while remaining crew will later sail the ship to the Netherlands for disinfection once evacuations are complete.
It's and they may say it's not like COVID, but it's not rhymes with COVID with how the breakout. My wife's cousin was on the cruise ship that was the first exposure that I think we had in the United States.
Okay,
The cruise ship in Japan back in February of 2020. So it's interesting. These things seem to start on cruise ships.
Yeah, it does. And well, what a bad place to be when those kind of things get out and start spreading around.
Yeah, cruise ships are thriving, I was reading over the weekend.
Are they?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Mike Lee. He's the managing editor of Crane's Detroit Business. Get all the business news going on in and around the city. That's next at 6:19 on JR Morning. Good morning. Welcome back to JR Morning. On a Monday, my co-host Jason Rowe, Republican political strategist from Rowe Strategic, here with me this morning. And also Mike Lee, managing editor of Crane's Detroit Business. This Crane's interview brought to you by Mercantile Bank. Looking for a new business bank? Mercantile can help drive your business forward. Learn more at mercbank.com. Mike Lee, good morning.
Good morning, Lloyd. How are you?
I am well. These data center developers, they're playing nicey-nice right now because these communities have really been giving them a lot of opposition.
Yeah, they're spending quite a bit of money playing nicey-nice. The developers of the giant data centers like the one in Saline Township that is rapidly rising out of the ground are spending big money on a PR campaign, kind of a charm offensive to make the case and push back against some of the pretty intense opposition, sometimes misinformation that have attached to these, that have had residents mounting recall elections and things like that against local officials. The most prominent one, and I'm sure folks have seen it, is the very folksy ad promoting the Saline Data Center, which they have named The Barn in the ad, and talking about how it's they're preserving farmland and providing tax benefits to the local government, and really making the case that this is a good thing for your town. Google also is making the rounds of the media, looking to correct what it calls disinformation. It's all part of a really an effort to probably a little bit late effort to make the case on how these data centers can be good for their local communities, as residents worry about power usage and water usage and noise and any other negative effects of having such a big operation in your town. The opposition to data centers runs up to 59% in polling, depending on how you ask the question. Lyon Township, another big data center intended for Anthropic. All seven township board members are the subject of a recall election. Really these companies are seeing that, it's time to make your case, because if you don't get loud with your message, the folks who oppose you will define the terms of the debate. So I don't think this debate is going anywhere anytime soon. So stay tuned.
Mike, Jason Rowe here. Good morning. One of the things that we've seen over the last year, 2 years even, is a lot more white collar layoffs in our economy as opposed to blue collar. And usually when we see job losses, it's more in the blue collar. We got a big merger coming up or in process here in Michigan between Fifth Third and Comerica. What's the impact going to be for Michigan and Metro Detroit?
Yeah, Fifth Third and Comerica have merged now. The Comerica name will be sunsetting very soon. Last week, the new development was Fifth Third filed a notice with the state that it plans to lay off a little over 500 people at what has been Comerica's Farmington Hills campus. Those cuts begin July 1st, run through November, and they've already laid some people off previously that didn't require such a warning. It's really, it's sort of a to be expected bit of fallout from a big bank merger like that, especially when the banks like Fifth Third and Comerica overlap in their territory as much as they did. In the future, you will almost certainly see some branch closings as well. They noted 76 branches in Michigan where they overlapped when they were seeking regulatory approval for this merger, 63 in Oakland, Wayne, Macomb County. So almost certainly some of those branches will be going away in the coming year. Fifth Third announced it's going to have its Michigan regional headquarters downtown in the One Campus Martius building, where Rocket is and owned by Dan Gilbert. But this is, this is pretty typical of a big bank merger. You mentioned white collar layoffs. There are fears that AI is driving those. I'm not totally sure that's actually true. But any time two large, very similar companies like this merge, you're going to lose some jobs, and it's unfortunate, but it's really part of the way business is done. So there we go.
Mike, I've ordered a few small things from Amazon, and just, I actually don't know if they were delivered by a drone or a truck. Usually I can hear the truck coming down the street, but I haven't heard one. So maybe they were delivered by a drone, but these drone services, they're really taking off here in Metro Detroit.
Yeah, this is what kind of caught my attention. Amazon has been talking about drone delivery being the future for a very long time. In a very small way, it is the future is now. They had had a bunch of journalists out last week, to their Pontiac facility, and they're now delivering about 100 drone deliveries a day in a small radius around Troy, Auburn Hills, Bloomfield Township. The deal is you pay an extra $5 and you'll have your items in 2 hours or less. And they've now done thousands of these deliveries, apparently. Some interesting wrinkles. It's for items only under 5 pounds. It has to be something that can survive being dropped from 13 feet in the air, because the drones aren't allowed to fly any lower than that to comply with FAA rules. Drones go 70 miles an hour, so they can deliver with speed, faster than a truck can get to your house. And Metro Detroit actually is just the second market in the country to really roll out this service in any kind of meaningful way. Amazon makes the case, drones, we're talking about job losses. Amazon says drones are meant to complement and not replace traditional delivery drivers. And I think with all the limitations on what you can actually deliver that way, at least for now, I think the drivers are safe, but it's a way in their constant, relentless push to speed up delivery. It's not too long ago that same day delivery was a pipe dream, and now it's pretty common. So a 2 hour delivery may be on the way to your doorstep soon.
Well, we can read these stories and others in Crane's Detroit Business. Mike Lee, managing editor, always great to have you here on a Monday morning, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Talk to you soon. Jason, real quick here before we go to the break. We know about Spirit Airlines and that situation with them, but they basically folded. Well, now we got this TikTok creator who's basically gone on with a crowdfunding, wants to save TikTok. And so far, he's raised like $335 million.
Crowdsourcing is a powerful tool nowadays.
Oh, man, $335 million. Now, we don't know if that's enough to do it, but I guess people, whoever complained about Spirit, somebody's given. You pay for everything else on Spirit, your baggage, everything. You might as well.
Now you got to pay to keep the airline in business.
Exactly. Coming up, we're going to take a look at Jamie Edmonds' latest podcast, Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way. We're going to hear a little bit of part two to kind of let you know what's going on with Jamie as she battles her cancer diagnosis. That's next on JR Morning.
On your ride home, check out the Mitch Albom Show at 4 p.m. Now to get your day started, here's JR Morning with Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds. Once again, in for Chris, here's Republican strategist Jason Rowe.
Good morning. Hey, I'm looking forward to hearing a little more about Jamie's journey. It's really, I think, very courageous for her to share what she's going through for people. And so many people are touched by cancer. And I've had a brief touch, and I would say fortunate. My father had prostate cancer, and we were shocked when we heard it, but it turned out to be a non-event for the surgery and the recovery, and never really bothered him again. But
wow.
Looking forward to hearing more about Jamie's journey.
And, as we all know, that Jamie recently shared that she's been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she is courageously undergoing treatment as we speak. And in true Jamie fashion, though, she's turning that journey into something powerful, launching a deeply personal podcast series called Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way. And today we're bringing you a portion of episode 2 where Jamie sits down with her breast surgeon from Henry Ford Health. It's, pretty honest. It's inspiring. And it's a reminder that even in life's toughest moments, none of us are alone.
Since I've started to be public about my story, I've gotten a lot of people reach out to me. I've talked to a 31-year-old mom who was breastfeeding when they found this. I've talked to sort of people in their 20s. And you know the stories of that are out there, the famous people like Olivia Munn and all this. These are young people. Why is this happening, especially in people that don't have the gene? It doesn't seem to be genetic. What are we doing to ourselves?
Yeah, so there's a lot of factors that go into that. I would say first and foremost, one of the things that I learned very early is that in patients that appear to have a genetic predisposition, it's about 20% of the patients we see. But of those 20%, only 10% have an identifiable gene. So it doesn't mean that it's not a genetic predisposition. We just don't know what gene we're necessarily looking for. So, and that's one of the reasons why risk assessment is really important. This isn't for cancer patients. This is for non-cancer patients. But if you have a family history, a significant family history, see somebody and have a risk assessment done, because it's entirely possible that outside of a known genetic predisposition, you're high risk and you should be screened in a different way. But in addition to these genetic predispositions that we may or may not know about, we know that there are other things happening, that environmental factors, we, you know, 80% of the cases we see are spontaneous. But I think too that there are just things that we don't know that are making these happen. But also too, we're much more open about these things and seeing them and these being diagnosed. I mean, if you look back years ago, these are, you didn't necessarily know it. One of the most poignant cases that I've ever had was a patient that was extremely young. She was BRCA positive and didn't know it because she had a family member that was diagnosed like generations back. They was diagnosed at an extremely young age and passed away, but nobody knew it was breast cancer. Mm. So it wasn't that the genetic history wasn't there. They just weren't aware of it because people didn't necessarily talk about it. And so we're kind of at this point in time where it's all coming to light and people are talking about it. It's not looked at as a stigma. So I think it's a combination of multiple things. Environment can be part of it too, but genetics is certainly there. And I do think that talking about it, bringing it to light so people aren't ashamed or don't think it's, you know, something that should be hidden is really important. And what you're doing, I think, is huge for that.
Well, I like that aspect of it, that we can talk about it. I mean, we're on a podcast talking about it, you know, and a long time ago, I don't think that would happen. So I think there's value here in the people that are going to be listening. I just know that all of my friends are looking for a way to protect themselves, be proactive. And a lot of them are doing all the right things. And sometimes, like it happened to me, it happens in between mammograms.
Yeah. I would say for all women, certainly, if you think you could be at high risk for whatever reason, family history, if you just have lumpy, bumpy breast, if something just doesn't feel right, talk to your PCP and see what they have to say. And if they are, you know, not certain, then find a breast specialist. I have no problem seeing somebody that's like, hey, I just want to know where I'm at, where I fall, and is this important? But certainly for the general population, mammograms at 40.
Okay. And I've gotten some messages from people who have listened to the story and they're like, I'm going to go get a mammogram. I'm like, great.
I think something else worth bringing up though, too, is if you feel something, don't assume it's okay. If you're not 40, just get it checked. I mean, I regularly see patients that have benign breast masses that are like, you know, I felt it. I've known it's there forever. And then all of a sudden it started growing. Like I will tell them, I love that you've been proactive. I love that you're here. But if you can tell anything or educate anyone, when you feel it initially, just come be seen. Don't wait. And oftentimes those are benign breast lesions, which are, you know, fine. We can manage those either by observation. Sometimes we have to remove them. But if you feel something, just ask.
That's just a glimpse into Jamie's journey, angels along the way from Jamie Edmonds. You know, her strength and her honesty and her faith, they really continue to inspire all of us. And you know, Jamie, we just want you to know that your family here at WJR, the listeners, all of us, we are with you every step of the way. And we encourage everyone to keep her lifted in love and support. We will be talking with Jamie in the 8 o'clock hour here on JR Morning. Jason, I got to ask you before we go to break about Benjamin Netanyahu, who was on 60 Minutes yesterday, and he says that it's social media that is eroding American support for his country. Major Garrett, the correspondent, said that a recent Pew survey found 60% of U.S. adults had an unfavorable view of Israel due to the war in Gaza, up to 20 points from 4 years ago, and he says more than 70,000 Gazans were killed, and that's according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. What do you think about him saying that it's social media that's eroding American support?
Well, I think there's some truth to it. Everyone seems to have forgotten the horrific terrorist attack on October 7th in Israel, killing nearly 2,000 people, as if that didn't happen to warrant what's been going on in the region. And I do think the progressive left has tried to find another wedge to divide the American people on a pretty important geopolitical situation. And, you know, I think Israel is the strongest ally the United States has on the globe, even more than the United Kingdom. So I do think there's some truth to that. And the left has been very good at using social media to influence public opinion. And this is a good example of it.
Tonight, game four of the Pistons versus the Cavs in Cleveland. We'll talk to Hunter Patterson, staff writer covering the Detroit Pistons for The Atlantic. He's next on JR Morning. Welcome back to JR Morning on a Monday here on 760 WJR. Jason Rowe, Republican strategist from Rowe Strategic, with me this morning. And after a tough game three loss in Cleveland, the conversation around the Pistons has gotten a whole lot louder, especially when it comes to Jalen Duren and his impact in this series. But as Detroit gets set for a pivotal game four tonight, the questions go far beyond one player. Is this about execution, adjustments, something deeper as the stakes rise in the playoffs? Joining us now to break it all down, what we saw Saturday and what we should expect tonight, is Hunter Patterson. He's a staff writer covering the Detroit Pistons for The Atlantic. Hunter, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. I appreciate y'all having me.
So let's start with Saturday. When you step back from the emotion of that game three loss, I mean, what actually went wrong for the Pistons down the stretch? Was it that Cleveland's head guy decided to wake up all of a sudden? Because that's what it seemed like it happened in the later part of the game.
I think turnovers had a huge impact on the game. The Pistons ended up battling back from being down 17. They kind of tightened the reins defensively, and then they were all even at a certain point. They had tied the game up, and then Cade had the late turnovers that he said post-game he wished he could have gotten back. And those eventually, I think, were pretty much the deciding factors in that game.
Yeah, you know, I think the real reason they ran is my mom blew up my Cade Cunningham prayer candle with 5 minutes left in the game. You know, one thing, I mean, you mentioned the turnovers. That's as amazing as Cade Cunningham is. He's got a turnover problem, and that's one place that, you know, if I had the standing to tell anybody what to do in the game of basketball, Cade needs to figure out a way to quit turning that ball over. He gets a little sloppy on offense.
Yeah, I think there's just a lot that he has to manage. He's averaging more minutes than anyone still playing in the postseason at this point. He's at about 40 and a half. He's tasked with guarding Harden for a large portion of the game. His usage percentage is high. It was higher than anyone other than Joel Embiid, and he just got eliminated yesterday. So he just has a lot on his shoulders at this point, and it's unfortunate. Turnovers obviously are a part of the game, but you would prefer to not have them decide the game, especially down the stretch on three straight possessions. So it's a challenge of his and an issue that spans back for a little bit, but I think he'll be better today and make sure he's more just in control of his movements and making better decisions down the stretch.
Hunter, at what point do you think the coaching staff will seriously consider going longer stretches with Paul Reed, especially after the spark he gave them in game three?
Paul's been tremendous at every opportunity he's had during the postseason, but I do think there is a just bigger picture approach with this postseason, and I believe that they'll continue to try to let Jalen Duren just overcome the challenges that he's had thus far with a mindset of, well, these are the natural kind of ebbs and flows of someone who is in his first postseason run as the what he, I guess, initially was supposed to be the number two. Tobias has stepped into that role. Mm-hmm. But last year, these expectations weren't really on JD just because it was his first postseason run. I don't think he was expected to be relied upon the way that he was coming into this postseason. And I think the staff just has a lot of trust in the fact that he is still only 22. And these are just post-game rigors I think that they feel he needs to go through. And I think that'll eventually result in Paul continuing to just see minutes sparingly.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the Orlando series, you know, I don't even know if he got on the court for the first few games when we were down. And when you watch him in this series and you watched him in the second half of the Orlando series, as soon as he's on the court, things happen. And it doesn't matter if it's on offense, if it's on defense, he's getting rebounds. I mean, he makes things happen. And, you know, when you look over the regular season, you know, when our bench played, that's when we did well. And I feel like the first few games in Orlando, we didn't see a lot from our bench.
Yeah, they the playoff rotation definitely just shrinks as opposed to the regular season. And Paul is someone who just has an uncanny ability to be in the right space at the right time. Sometimes it may look unorthodox, but he has a level of confidence that allows him to just be effective in multiple ways. And even outside of him, I think Karis has played well over the last couple games, especially defensively. Ron has played well in his minutes off the bench, so the bench has done as much as they can, but just based on the fact that the playoff rotations are just inherently shrink, I think may not allow for there to be as much rhythm off the bench as the regular season.
Speaking with Hunter Patterson, staff writer covering the Detroit Pistons for the Atlantic. And Hunter, coming into tonight's game four, who do you think is under the most pressure? Would it be Durin, Kay, even maybe JB?
This team is one that has a certain level of confidence to the point where I'm not sure they feel quote-unquote pressure. I know Kay, in talking to him throughout the first round against the Magic, he's someone who feels pressure can be a privilege at times. Paul Reed had a great quote when I spoke with him, and he mentioned pressure either bursts pipes or makes diamonds. And he felt that they had produced a diamond in the first round by coming back from that 3-1 deficit. So I think this team doesn't really feel a ton of pressure, but I expect them to play a lot better than they did a couple of days ago.
Hunter Patterson, staff writer covering the Detroit Pistons for the Atlantic. We appreciate you coming on this morning. Go Pistons. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. I appreciate y'all having me.
All right. Coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, we'll be speaking with the Republican candidate for Michigan Secretary of State, Anthony Forlini, and we'll get you an update on the water main break that's really giving northern Oakland County a run. A lot of people without water could be without water for the next 2 weeks or so. We'll give you an update coming up here on 760 WJR.
It's not just morning. It's a JR morning with Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds on 760 WJR and on the WJR app, where Michigan comes to talk. Filling in today for Chris Renwick, here's Republican strategist Jason Rowe.
Jason, it's nice to see you, buddy. Thanks for being here this morning.
Hey, great to be here. This is fun.
Got to talk about the Pistons.
We do.
Because tonight, game four in Cleveland, and they couldn't survive their own mistakes down the stretch. The score was 116-109 on Saturday. And after, you know, coming back from that 17-point deficit and tying the game at 104, Pistons unraveled in a critical 40-second span. Kate Cunningham threw in inbounds pass. Oh, that was so hurtful. That was intercepted by Max Strauss and leading to a go-ahead fast break layup for Cleveland. Moments later, Cunningham committed two more turnovers, and the Cavaliers capitalized on that. James Harden then closed the door. He woke up all of a sudden. Seven straight points. Cleveland trimmed Detroit's series lead 2-1. Cunningham finished with 27 points, 10 rebounds, 10 assists, 8 turnovers, acknowledging costly late-game errors. And despite that strong 28-9 third quarter run sparked by Paul Reed, the Pistons just couldn't hold on, and Coach J.B. Bickerstaff again leaning on late lineup decisions as Detroit looks to regroup for game four, which is tonight, 8 o'clock, NBC. What did you think about the game?
Well, I'm not worried. One, I mean, we saw how resilient the team was when we were down 3-1 against Orlando.
Sure.
I mean, that was as impressive a stretch as we've seen in the Pistons this season. Listen, we won two games at home and we won them. I mean, that was, these were not, we didn't slip by.
No.
We won.
Yeah.
We went on the road. We lost one, but we were in it all the way to the end. So I'm not worried about this team being able to bounce back and take care of business. And listen, I want it to go seven games because I want to watch seven games. I don't want to. I don't want to end this early.
I wanted to get done because I'm ready for us to take on New York. New York swept Philadelphia yesterday, so that's going to be our next opponent if we can get through this Cleveland series. And I think if we win tonight, then the next game is here at LCA. I think we can.
We would have taken care of New York last year
if
we were healthy.
Exactly.
I mean, it was just we had three guys.
That's right.
That weren't there, and if they were there, we would have taken care of business. Could look at what happened to New York in the next round.
And we owned them in the regular season. We beat them all three games in the regular season. So,
and there's no one I like to hate like Jalen Brunson.
Oh God! You know, my wife, you and my wife would get along because she's the same way. A major water main break causing emergency conditions across parts of Oakland County after a critical failure early yesterday morning. The Great Lakes Water Authority says residents in Orion Township, the village of Lake Orion, Rochester Hills, and Northern Auburn Hills should only use water for essential needs like drinking, cooking, and basic sanitation. Officials in Orion Township have declared a state of emergency and issued a boil water advisory warning the outage could last up to 2 weeks as repairs are made. The break happened on a 42-inch transmission line in Riverwoods Park in Auburn Hills, forcing crews to isolate the system and begin emergency response efforts. Officials are urging residents to conserve water immediately, while distribution sites have been set up to provide bottled water. In the meantime, the massive water main break is causing major disruptions this morning, not only in residential kitchens, but also at the headquarters of one of the world's largest automakers. Following that state of emergency declaration in Auburn Hills, Stellantis has ordered the majority of its workforce to stay home today. Employees at the Chrysler Tech Center and several surrounding facilities are instructed to work remotely while the city grapples with this mandatory boil water advisory. Residents in Orion Township, Lake Orion, Rochester Hills, Northern Auburn Hills are urged to limit water use. And the rupture in Auburn Hills has triggered a wave of school closures and operational shifts across the region as well. Lake Orion Community Schools will remain closed today and tomorrow. The Avondale School District and Crown of Life Preschool have canceled all classes for today. And also Oakland Community College has shifted its Auburn Hills campus to remote learning until further notice. Local officials warn that because of the scale of the damage, repairs, as you know, could take 2 weeks, and residents and parents are encouraged to check for further updates as far as schools in that area. This is a pretty bad situation.
Well, it gives everyone an opportunity to appreciate the wonder of one of the greatest inventions in mankind, and that is the toilet.
Yes.
I don't think people quite realize, and we take for granted, how important the toilet is in our lives. And not having access to one will certainly remind people. But as you know, the Stellantis employees are not happy that they got to be back in the office 5 days a week. And so I'm calling on Attorney General Dana Nessel to do an investigation to see if Stellantis employees didn't sabotage to the water main there.
President Donald Trump escalating his rhetoric after Iran responded to new U.S. proposal aimed at ending the war. He called it totally unacceptable. The statement came just hours after Iranian officials through Pakistan mediation confirmed that they had delivered a response to the peace plan amid renewed tensions near the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump accused Iran of playing games with the U.S. while warning that its leadership would no longer be laughing at American efforts. The diplomatic back and forth comes as clashes continue in the region, including U.S. strikes on Iranian-linked tankers and ongoing concerns over disruptions to global shipping routes. Your thoughts on that? I mean, I think the president really doesn't want to go military if he can help it, but that may be what we have to do.
Well, we've been told for 2.5 months that reliably the war will be over tomorrow, but tomorrow never comes. But I think the ceasefire was a mistake. I think that gave the Iranian leadership an opportunity to regroup and find some leverage, that leverage being the Strait of Hormuz. If it weren't for that, you know, this thing would be, for all intents and purposes, done.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it exposed NATO. NATO is supposed to be an alliance that backs up each other. And historically, it's been the United States using its military to defend European countries. And this is an opportunity that NATO had in which they're directly impacted, that they should have been backing us up, and maybe this wouldn't be the situation that we're in.
Coming up, we'll be speaking with Anthony Forlini. He's the Republican candidate for Michigan's Secretary of State. But first, it's time for WJR's Business Beat. It's brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial, tech, and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. With Mother's Day retail sales now in the books, it's time to move on from appreciating our moms. Well, okay, not really. Who are we kidding, after all? It's time that we turn our attention, though, to how did Mother's Day perform for our retailers this year? Data from the National Retail Federation indicates that consumers this year made purchases across a wide variety of categories, pushing spending to new records. This year, Mother's Day shoppers spent an average of $284.25 per person for a total spend of around $38 billion. Who did all that spending? While both men and women spent more this year, it's men that continue to be most likely to splurge. This year, men budgeted an average of $346 per person compared to women's $225 per person. Now, all age groups spent more this year. Millennials spent the most, maintaining their place as the generation with the largest budgets for their beloved moms. These shoppers are also among those most likely to gift experiences as opposed to things, with millennials along with Gen Z leading the way with gifts like concerts, sporting events, and more. The bottom line, consumers across all income groups upped their ante this year to celebrate our beloved moms. Unsurprisingly, higher income consumers had the greatest spending increases, but lower and middle income consumers also spent more on the holiday. So there you have it. Do we love our moms or what? Of course we do. And we spent heavily this year to show them some love and then some. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com. The source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
And welcome back to JR Morning on a Monday with my special co-host, Jason Rowe, Republican political strategist from Rowe Strategies. And Michigan Republicans have made their choice for Secretary of State, nominating Anthony Forlini after a decisive first ballot win at their state convention. The longtime Macomb County clerk now heads into a high-stakes general election, positioning himself as an experienced election administrator focused on doing the job and putting politics aside. But in a race that's expected to draw statewide attention, voters will be looking closely at what sets him apart and what changes he believes are needed in one of Michigan's most important offices. Joining us now to talk about his campaign and vision is Anthony Forlini. Anthony, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
First of all, let me say congratulations on securing that nomination. And were you surprised to win on the first ballot in what many expected to be a multi-round race?
Well, you know, we all did. We all expected to go multi-round, but it was refreshing to see that we had a broad support by the Republican delegates to be voted in on the first round. So that was very humbling and refreshing, particularly after a long day.
Hey, Tony, Jason Rowe, good morning. Congratulations to you and your team. That really was an impressive victory at the state party convention. I was a voting delegate, and I was proud to support you, and a really impressive accomplishment to get it done so efficiently and unite the party in the way that you did. You know, looking forward to November, you're going against Garland Gilchrist, who, as of right now, has never won an election in his life. He did run for city clerk in Detroit and lost against Janice Winfrey. He was chosen to be lieutenant governor, so didn't get elected to that job, and actually had to abort his campaign for governor to jump over into the Secretary of State's race. How do you view the contrast between you and Lieutenant Governor Gilchrist going in, both in terms of electability, but also in terms of what your agenda and priorities are compared to his?
Well, I think that's an important contrast because, you know, I've come up through the ranks as a township supervisor, as a state representative, and as a county clerk. And we did it, you know, earning the votes of our constituency. So I think it's really important that we represent the people of the state of Michigan and what they are looking for. And I think we've been successful in the past because we recognize that. We put politics aside. I've always put politics aside because I wanted to make sure that we were providing a service, that we were empowered with. You know, the people of Michigan aren't looking for us to be political. They're looking for us to get the job done, particularly as Secretary of State. What do we want? Less lines, fair elections, a government that works for you. And that's all that the people are looking for. They're not looking for all the other identity politics and whatnot that you're seeing happening so much in today's politics.
And Anthony, a Macomb County clerk, you know, as Macomb County clerk, I know you've been a chief elections official there for a long time. And Macomb is really kind of looked at as a purple county. How is working in a politically divided area kind of prepared you for this statewide race?
Again, that's, I think, very important. I believe that we have support of many Democrats in Macomb County as well as Republicans. And sometimes it's the fringe players that'll try to pull us away from what our real vision and what we're trying to do for the county and providing a great service. So I think statewide, it's the same thing. People are looking for sensibility. They're looking for leadership. They're looking for people that are, they can go to work and do their thing. We just do ours, and let's put everything else aside. And I believe that's what I bring to the table, always have and always will.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the good outcomes of the Republican convention is we nominated you, someone with vast experience in the portfolio of the job of Secretary of State, as well as Doug Lloyd, a 16-year prosecutor from Eaton County, as our Attorney General nominee. This is a really good slate, and I think, you know, with Mike Rogers in the Senate race and a very qualified field for governor, you know, how do you look at the landscape going into 2026? Obviously, Republicans right now are facing a headwind due to the Iran war and gas prices, which are not something we can really address at the state issue or at the state level. But looking forward, how do you feel about the slate of candidates on the Republican side going into the election?
I'm incredibly optimistic. You know, I never knew Doug Lloyd prior to our run for the offices that we're running for. And along the way, I really got to meet a complete gentleman that understands the law, that understands what he was elected to do, and not to create lawfare, but to be right and fair with the residents. So, you know, I'm plugging Doug because Doug has really done a great job, and I've never met a finer man in my life. So that goes a long way with me.
And he looks like an attorney general with that deep baritone voice.
You know what? Be careful, guys. He's got a great voice for radio.
Hey. Yeah. Watch out.
He's got that deep voice, and I love teasing him along the way because he's got that deep, deep voice. And but what a gentleman he is, and what a great partner to be running across the state, talking about our vision for Michigan and bringing sensibility back to the offices of Attorney General and Secretary of State.
Speaking with Anthony Ferlini, Republican candidate for Michigan Secretary of State. And Anthony, you know, when voters hear Secretary of State, a lot of times they often think about elections. But, you know, the office does much more. Talk about maybe some of your top priorities beyond the elections.
Well, you know, we've proven it here at Macomb County. We have the third largest county in the state of Michigan, 850,000 people or so. And we've turned wait times around from several weeks when it came to the CPLs and a long period of time waiting in our office to get services taken care of to an office that within 4 minutes, you're up to the counter, and within 10, you're out the door. And that's what people are looking for. Just, you know, hey, listen, I got to get my tabs renewed. I want to come down without an appointment, and I want to get it done in a quick, efficient way. And that's what we're going to bring to the office. The other thing that nobody's talking about is the Office of the Great Seal. The Office of the Great Seal is really under attack under the notary division because it's old laws, old way of handling things. People are coming to the office, are bringing deeds to our office that the notary isn't legitimate, and we got to fix that. There's going to be a little bit of work there, and we're going to get that done.
Yeah, Tony, you obviously were successful in winning at convention. There's conversations that I've been involved in about taking the nomination process out of conventions and letting voters weigh in a primary like we do for governor, U.S. Senate, et cetera. Do you have any thoughts on that coming out of, you know, having won, but even Secretary Benson as a candidate for governor has proposed that this might be an antiquated way of choosing our candidates?
Yeah, I think we're only and I could be wrong, it is one of three states that actually do it this way still. And it disenfranchises so many Republican voters that really don't even understand this. As a matter of fact, they tell me, hey, we're going to vote for you in August. I go, well, you don't get a chance to do that. We've done it already. And they look at me like, what? Most people on the streets do not understand that. So it probably is antiquated. It is something that I think that we should look at. And, you know, moving the primary date from August back maybe to June or May is a great idea to really kind of compromise between the two, to have a candidate earlier and to have the public be able to vet the Republican and the Democrat or any independent that might be out there much longer time. And I think that's, I believe that's a good idea.
And Anthony, we got about a minute left, but I got to ask you, you know, a couple of things that people are talking about: election security and voter access. How do you balance ensuring election security while also maintaining that voter access and confidence in the system?
Well, first off, I believe in order to have confidence, you need to have accountability. And you might have seen a little bit of that in the Democrat convention that they had, a little bit of chaos, because some of that was missing. We're going to bring that to the state of Michigan so that every voter is enfranchised and knows that their vote counted.
Anthony Ferlini, Republican candidate for Michigan Secretary of State. A pleasure having you on, and good luck in the race.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Lloyd.
All right. And coming up, the executive director of the Founders Fund will talk about the Michigan Tech Week event that's running from May 19th to the 21st. That's next at 7:35 on JR Morning.
Stick around for All Talk at 9 with Kevin Dietz. Then Focus with Paul W. Smith at noon on 760 WJR and on the WJR app. Now it's JR Morning. Here's Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds. Once again in for Chris, here's Republican strategist Jason Rowe.
Jason, good to have you here on a Monday.
Good morning.
Got up early with us.
Getting pumped up for the Pistons tonight.
Oh, Pistons got to do it tonight, and I think they will. We get this one tonight. I think we come back to LCA and close it out. Yeah, definitely. Well, Detroit is once again taking center stage in the future of innovation as Michigan Founders Fund prepares to host Michigan Tech Week, bringing together more than 1,000 founders, investors, and corporate leaders from across the country. And this year's event at Michigan Central in Corktown is all about creating real opportunity and connecting high-growth startups with global companies and sparking partnerships and driving the kind of innovation that can shape Michigan's economic future. Joining us now to talk about what's new and what it means for the state is Executive Director Rishi Mogill. Rishi, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here with you.
For people who may not be familiar yet, what is Michigan Tech Week and why has it become such an important event in the state?
Well, Michigan Tech Week is a high-growth founder conference, and what we mean by that are often tech-driven businesses that have disruptive ideas that can really scale and scale quickly. And so we're bringing together the state, these founders, investors, corporate innovation teams, university research departments, all these folks together for a couple days over at Michigan Central in order to both celebrate the successes that we've had and start planning for how Michigan can continue on a path towards being a top 10 innovation economy.
Rishi, Jason Rowe here. In a past life, I was the chief of staff at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and curious for you know, innovators who don't necessarily understand the importance of intellectual property and protecting their inventions. How do you advise and prepare people that might not be familiar with the kind of Byzantine process, whether it is copyright, patent, or trademark, to protect what they've created?
Yeah, so that's actually one of many topics we cover at our conference. As you know, intellectual property is a key driver on that. We actually have folks from the patent office with us talking about intellectual property, which is one of many pieces. And that's why, specifically for this conference, right, these are business owners that really need a different sort of specialized support in order to protect their property, find the types of capital, which is risk, growth capital. It's different than traditional business capital, and get the supports and teams that can really drive their technologies forward once they're protected and they're ready to launch.
What are corporations actually looking for when they come to something like this, Rishi? And what do Michigan startups need to do to kind of stand out?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. That's one unique thing we're doing this year that we haven't traditionally spent enough time, in our state, which is we have these great corporations with R&D and innovation teams within those companies, but they also seek out the next technologies. They're also looking for what are some of the cutting edge possibilities for their businesses to also accelerate. And so this is really the power of Michigan Tech Week, where we're bringing together those founders that may not be well known yet, but really have that kind of cutting edge next stage business idea or technology, and bringing these two sides together to figure out how could they pilot on product development? Could they do research and development together? Is there sales first customer opportunities? And just really bridging what are two ends of sort of the business spectrum, those that are well established and those that are just starting off, to succeed together.
And are you seeing any particular sectors that are driving the innovation economy? Is it healthcare? Is it auto related? Anything that stands out to you?
Well, we certainly have strengths in those that you just mentioned, and certainly one of the traditional strengths of Michigan being around, building things, advanced manufacturing, hard tech, auto, mobility. Those are certainly hot topics. And really, when we think about how do you fuse what is happening right now with AI with the ability to actually build and have and manufacture products, those are two themes that you might think of separately, software, hardware, but really the future is integrating those, and it's a number of topics we'll be going deeper on at Michigan Tech Week.
Speaking with Rishi Mogill, he's executive director of the Michigan Founders Fund. And Rishi, let's talk about Michigan Central as a host site. I mean, how symbolic is it to have this happening in Corktown, right in the heart of Detroit's innovative push?
Absolutely. Well, one of the key things in the last couple of years, as you know, for us in Detroit is Michigan Central and a lot of the innovative efforts that have happened to really accelerate the state and the region around being an innovative hub. And folks are flying in from all over the country because they want to see Michigan Central. They want to meet these founders that they've heard of that are doing, very different and innovative things. So we're pretty excited to have them as our host and partner.
How much opportunity is there for exhibitors to get investments from, from private equity or, any of the investment opportunities that are out there? Is there real opportunities here?
Well, that's another thing we're trying to uncover exactly is, what is that risk capital often, around the spectrum of venture capital, angel investments, and otherwise? We have a lot of founders who are first time to this, and so we try to educate and uncover those opportunities here at Michigan Tech Week. And those that are advanced, that have already, maybe grown or launched tech enterprises, we're bringing in those specialized investors from around the state and the country in order to create a critical mass so that they can get exposure and find the right types of capital. Because often the case is if you want to grow at the pace of these tech-driven companies, you need both local capital, but likely also need to attract outside capital as well.
Rishi Mogill is executive director of the Michigan Founders Fund. Rishi, thank you so much for spending a little time with us this morning, giving us an update on the Michigan Tech Week event, which runs from May 19th to the 21st at Michigan Central. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jason, got to ask you, there is a meeting coming up this week between the president and Xi Jinping, and I'm sure the president would have loved to have this Iran situation wrapped up before the meeting, but what do you think those two will be discussing?
Well, he's bringing a lot of business leaders, and obviously, our relationship with China is less about, maybe the divisions militarily and more economically. I mean, they have been a threat to our economy ever since they ascended to the WTO and ever since we extended permanent normal trade relations back in 2000 and 2001. I never quite understood why we were empowering one of our economic rivals in the way that we have. But, you know, those decisions with free trade really eroded our manufacturing base in the United States. And so what drives a lot of the tariff policies is trying to, you know, onshore a lot of the manufacturing that we've lost to China and a lot of other countries. I think, though, as we talked about during one of the breaks, you know, when we first, you know, attacked Iran, the military display that we saw was really impressive. But also, I think it sent a big signal to the world and to China, because China was providing the technology to Iran that was supposed to intercept our missiles and our airplanes. And I think we made mincemeat of their systems. And I think we demonstrated that there is no military in the entire world with the power and dominance that we have. And, you know, had we ended this thing with in short order, I think President Trump would have been rolling into this meeting with a big flex. Now we find ourselves a little bit vulnerable and a little bit spread thin.
Yeah.
And I don't think China, you know, sees us maybe as much of a threat today as they did 2.5 months ago.
Well, we know if this war was not going on, the gas prices would not be where they are today. And if you didn't buy gas yesterday, you might be sorry today. We'll talk about the gas prices, what's going on, with Richard Burr, Metro editor of the Detroit News, next at 7:49 on JR Morning. Welcome back to JR Morning on a Monday, as we get ready for those Detroit Pistons tonight in Cleveland, Game 4, NBC, 8 p.m. Now, if it feels like you're paying more every time you fill up, well, you're not imagining it. Gas prices across Michigan have jumped about 20 cents in just the past week, pushing us among the highest in the country. That's according to the American Automobile Association. With global tensions and seasonal fuel changes and supply concerns all in play, drivers are feeling the squeeze at the pump and wondering what comes next. Joining us now to break it all down, from what's driving the spike to whether any relief is in sight, is Richard Burr. He is Metro editor at the Detroit News. Richard, it's good to have you on this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's start with what drivers are feeling right now. Gas prices in Michigan jumping about 20 cents in just a week. What's driving that sudden spike?
So we've got a couple of things going on. The price spike that really hit about a little bit more than a week ago was a combination of fears about tightening supplies in the Strait of Hormuz, which drove the price of oil up temporarily. And then we've been having refinery issues in the Midwest. And there was so it's not unusual for refineries to do maintenance in the spring. But then there was a issue with the biggest refinery in the Midwest, and it went down for about 4 or 5 days. And that supply shock helped to accentuate the problem, especially for Midwest drivers and Michigan drivers.
Hey, Richard, Jason Rowe. You know, we hear a lot of analysis about how long it would take to get the flow of oil coming out of the Strait of Hormuz if we, you know, were to be able to secure it. You know, I've argued in some of my conversations with people that markets don't necessarily respond to supply, but what the long-term prospects are. How long do you think it's going to take if we are able to open up the Strait of Hormuz and get a stabilized military situation in Iran for oil prices to come down and, more importantly, gas prices to come down?
Well, I wish I was in that field, because then I could make a lot more money. But from what I read from the experts, usually if they're oil markets respond in real time to real time events. So you could see the price of oil for future contracts start to go down fairly quickly if experts, you know, discern that, you know, there's an actual deal, that shipments are stabilizing, and that would tend to drive the price of oil down. As far as when we would see it at the pump, it's hard to say. It could be a week or two. But it all depends, because sometimes gas prices are kind of sticky going on the way down, meaning some gas station owners don't want to shock people if, like, a tentative agreement goes sideways, and then they have to start increasing prices again. So sometimes they're very cautious, which is why prices over the last week have been inching down like a 1 cent or two each day of the week as gasoline demand has been going down and the price of oil has stabilized around $95 per barrel.
Richard, let's bring it local. Where are drivers in Michigan feeling it the most? And is there still anywhere here that we can find some relief?
I can tell people that if they really want to find out the best place to get current gas prices and try to buy at the best price, your best bet is to go to GasBuddy.com. Mm-hmm. It's a Dallas-based tracking firm, and they keep track of all the prices they pay people to report in gas prices. So, like this morning, they're reporting that, like, if you wanted to get the cheapest gas, they're saying there's an Amoco station in Allen Park that's selling gas for $4.14 a gallon. And that's what they have, at least as the lowest price here mm-hmm. in the Metro Detroit area. You'll tend to find the largest, the higher prices tend to be outstate, moreover in Western Michigan or Northern Michigan. Sometimes it's the further you are away you are from a source or of a refinery or whatnot, and yeah. then the transportation costs go up.
Richard, my understanding is that the U.S. produces 80% of the oil that we use in this country. If that's in fact the case, why are we experiencing such a huge spike in gas prices if we don't rely on the Gulf for our oil like other parts of the world do?
Well, prices are a global phenomenon, and so that has part of an impact on it. The other thing that comes into play here lately is the refining capacity. I don't think people understand. We've been fairly stable as far as refinery capacity. For 40 years, there was a very small refinery built and opened in Texas 4 years ago. But before that, the last major refinery that was opened was in Louisiana in 1977. And so what you've had is because of the environmental concerns and because there's usually opposition to the building of any new refinery, and it could be years to a decade or more before a new refinery would even come online, because of all the hoops you have to jump through, what you're finding is that refineries try to increase their capacity, but because the capacity is so tight, if you have a couple of them go down, then that affects the supply. So, for instance, there was a fire and explosion at a refinery in Louisiana last Friday, mm-hmm. and that's part of why GasBuddy said you got to watch out. Prices might start going up here in the next few days because there was kind of a shock to the refinery system.
Richard Burr, Metro Editor of the Detroit News. We appreciate you coming on and giving your insight this morning. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And as we were talking a little earlier, Jason, about the meeting with the president and Xi Jinping, I'm sure gas or, you know, oil will be part of that discussion as well, because China gets a lot of their oil through the straits.
Well, and this, again, 2.5 months ago was one of the areas that we squeezed them a little bit between what we did in Venezuela and what we were doing with Iran. Mm-hmm. They were buying a lot of this sanctioned oil for below market prices. And so they were getting, in effect, subsidized oil into the country.
Yeah.
And we took that away from them. But because of this thing dragging on the way it is, we lost that momentary advantage.
Also, I'm sure on the minds of the president and Xi Jinping, this BYD, you know, being allowed into the United States and allowing them, if they were to come into the United States, I mean, it's going to lower consumer prices, but potentially hollow out the American auto industry. And the question is, can the president balance his what he calls 12 out of 10 relationship with Xi against this America First manufacturing base?
It's a disastrous policy to allow BYD into the United States market.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll talk more about that next hour. Also next hour, we will speak with Jamie Edmonds. She'll be checking in, talking about episode 2 of her podcast. Also, the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee will join us. And also, we'll talk about those Pistons who play game 4 tonight in Cleveland. Can we get a win in Cleveland and bring it back here and wrap it all up? Also, that big water main break that's affecting northern Oakland County. Give you the latest on that as well as JR Morning continues on a Monday, 760 WJR.
It's another JR Morning with Chris Renwick, Boy Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds on 760 WJR and streaming on WJR.com, where Michigan comes to talk. Filling in today for Chris Renwick, here's Republican strategist Jason Rowe.
Jason, I haven't run you away yet. You're still here. So I'm glad you're still here this morning.
That's because I want those Monday munchies.
Oh, yeah. See, there you go. That's all. I knew it was
Save
something
to it.
Save
them to the end of the show.
I knew it was something to keep me here. Yeah, I knew it was something to it. The Pistons tonight, game 4 in Cleveland. And we lost game 3. Well, you know, we got some things we need to clean up.
A little bit of cleanup. Mostly those turnovers, particularly at the end of the game. And, you know, as I said earlier, that bench play, I know when we had Hunter on, he was talking about in the playoffs, you rely on your starters a little more, but that's not the formula that got us to the playoffs. And we've seen when the bench shows up, the fortunes of the team change, and our bench has stepped up. I mean, Tobias is a starter, but, man, he's had some games. And you watch B-Ball Paul come off the bench. You watch Paris LeVert last couple games. Like, these guys are showing up. We need them. That's what makes this team so good is we're so deep. I mean, anybody on that roster can step on the court and make a play. And, you know, Hunter talked about, you know, how many minutes Cade's putting in.
Yeah.
Let's give him a little rest. Let's give all those starters a little bit of rest. But also we're giving our opponents different looks. So I think it makes sense to do what got us here, which is bring those guys in off the bench and make things happen.
I agree 100% because when Kate was out with the lung injury, I mean, we were still winning.
Jenkins, I mean, that guy, we're lucky we got him that 2-year contract when we did, or he'd be starting for someone else right now.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think I like the giving them different looks. I think that helps us. James Harden, I mean, he came off in the last part. I mean, he was, you know, kind of a ghost, a zombie, and then he just kind of woke up.
There's no better flopper in the NBA.
That is true. So game 4 tonight, the Pistons are up 2-1. We play game 4 tonight, and if we can get one in Cleveland, I think we bring it back Wednesday here at LCA, and we wrap it up. So tonight's game, 8 o'clock. NBC, check it out.
And I've got a working dinner tonight, and I just want to warn my guests that I will be watching it on my iPad if it's not on in the restaurant, so just get ready.
Okay, well, fair warning. Another fair warning about that major water main break. It's causing emergency conditions across part of Oakland County, and after a critical failure early yesterday morning, the Great Lakes Water Authority saying residents in Orion Township, the village of Lake Orion, Rochester Hills, and Northern Auburn Hills should only use water for essential needs like drinking, cooking, and basic sanitation. Officials in Orion Township have declared a state of emergency and issued a boil water advisory warning. The outage could last up to 2 weeks as repairs are made. The break happened on a 42-inch transmission line in Riverwoods Park in Auburn Hills, forcing crews to isolate the system and begin emergency response efforts. They've been working overnight, all night. They were out there working in the pitch dark. They had lights set up. They're trying to get this taken care of as quick as possible, and officials are urging residents to conserve their water, and there are some distribution sites have been set up to provide bottled water as well. Also, it's affecting Stellantis. They have ordered the majority of its workforce to stay home today. Employees at the Chrysler Tech Center and several surrounding facilities are instructed to work remotely while the city grapples with this mandatory boil water advisory. Governor Gretchen Whitmer activating the State Emergency Operations Center declared a state of emergency following the water main break. The declaration provides for the use of available state resources to help local response and recovery operations. And that rupture is also causing some schools to be closed. The Lake Orion Community Schools will remain closed today and tomorrow. while the Avondale School District and Crown of Life Preschool have canceled classes for today. And the impact also hitting Oakland Community College. They've shifted its Auburn Hills campus to remote learning until further notice. This is a big deal. In 2 weeks is a long time.
Yeah, I feel bad for the people impacted by this. I mean, this is such an incredible disruption to your lives, those with kids, but also the businesses. I mean, think how many restaurants and other businesses in that area missed out on Mother's Day. I mean, that's a huge, huge day for restaurants and all the businesses that will be impacted by this. I mean, that's a pretty big blow.
Large-scale evacuation underway after the hantavirus outbreak aboard the cruise ship, which docked in Spain. Spanish health officials say 94 passengers from 19 nationalities were safely evacuated on the first day of operations. Travelers ferried ashore in small boats before being transferred to airports for repatriation. The ship arrived carrying 147 people after three deaths were linked to the rare virus during its voyage from Argentina. Health officials stress the risk to the public remains low, with the World Health Organization noting the situation is not comparable to COVID. And passengers are being sent to multiple countries for monitoring and treatment, while remaining crew will later sail the ship to the Netherlands for disinfection once evacuations are complete. And we're expecting to get an update on the situation on the cruise ship around 10 o'clock this morning. But what a scary situation to be on a cruise ship like that and have that type of virus running through it.
Yeah, well, I have not yet heard which cruise line, and I didn't look very hard, but I also heard that the virus is spread by rat droppings. So mm-hmm. I think whoever's cruise ship line that is probably grateful that there's not a lot of news coverage on which cruise line it is.
Maybe so. And an arrest has been made in connection with that arson incident inside Huntington Place in downtown Detroit. According to the Detroit Fire, the suspect entered the building shortly after 9 on April 26, carrying water bottles filled with gas. Investigators say he poured fuel onto the carpeting and then he lit it. The fire caused only minimal damage and was quickly extinguished by responders. No injuries reported, no impact to guest staff or scheduled events. Authorities say the break in the case came from a tip from a witness who recognized the suspect after seeing news coverage of the incident. Officials have not released the suspect's identity pending arraignment as that investigation continues. So I'm sure that we'll hear about that from the prosecutor's office sometime either today or tomorrow. But it just goes to show you that there are cameras everywhere and everybody knows everybody. And I'm sure somebody saw the news coverage of that and said, hey, yeah, I know who that guy is. Yeah, he's down the street. He's doing, you know, so it was just a matter of time.
I'm anxious to learn why he's so angry at the Huntington Place that he wanted to burn it down.
Yeah, absolutely. And Metro Detroiters turned effort into impact this past Saturday at CrossFit in the D, where more than 80 teams rode 1 million meters to raise money for a program helping cancer survivors rebuild strength through fitness. The event, supported by Capable Program, which provides 12 weeks of free CrossFit training at gyms across Southeast Michigan for people recovering from cancer. Organizers say 100% of the donations go directly back to the participants for equipment and continued training, with survivors and supporters rowing side by side throughout the challenge. For many, the event was deeply personal, drawing families affected by cancer, healthcare workers, and survivors like 78-year-old Fred Hardy, who says staying active has been key to his recovery. Officials behind the program say the goal is simple but powerful, proving that fitness can be part of healing and that no one has to face cancer alone.
It's good work that they're doing.
Very good work. And speaking of that, we'll be speaking with Jamie Edmonds. She's going to join us at 8:19 to talk about how she's doing, how she's feeling, and episode 2 of her latest podcast. We'll be talking with her coming up shortly, along with the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee. Monday Munchies on the way. A lot of stuff happening here in the 8 o'clock hour here on JR Morning, 760 WJR. Welcome back to JR Morning. Jason Rowe, Republican political strategist, Rowe Strategic, here with me this morning. And Jason, we talked a little earlier about cancer and how it has affected not just my family, but your family as well.
Yeah, I don't think there's probably many people in the country that aren't touched, you know, at least an extended family or friends, mm-hmm. if not in their immediate families. You know, scary thing for anybody to navigate, and that what makes what Jamie's been doing so impressive and courageous, to see her help people understand the journey she's on and understand what goes into the treatment and you know, navigating what goes on in cancer treatment.
Absolutely. And Jamie recently shared that she's been diagnosed with breast cancer and is courageously undergoing treatment. But in true Jamie fashion, she's turning her journey into something powerful, launching a deeply personal podcast series called Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way. And she joins us now to give us a taste of what the episode 2 of her podcast is all about. Jamie, good morning.
Good morning to you both. You know, my mother-in-law just said that something Oprah said a long time ago is you try and make your mess into a message. And now I feel that deeply because that's my whole point with this podcast.
And I got to ask you, how you doing? How you feeling?
I'm okay. Monday's my best day because it's just right before the treatment again. You mm-hmm. know, your body's like recovering. So I feel pretty good today. I'm hopefully going to get number 11 done tomorrow morning at Henry Ford Cancer. And just ticking these things off, trying to get to the end of this.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I've been loving the podcast, Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way. You had episode 2 that dropped last week, and kind of give us a little detail on what it was and introduce this clip.
Okay. This is with a future angel, I called her, oncologist breast surgeon. And she talks about everything that happens and how there's this team at Henry Ford that sort of descends on you after you get this news. And they meet weekly about every single patient and how things are going. And so we got into all kinds of things. My case is a baseline, but I tried to talk about everything to sort of include anyone who might be on the journey, who might be listening. And also I talked about being proactive, because as Jason said, a lot of people are touched by cancer, but I'm kind of the first in my friend group, and all my friends are asking about now, how can they be proactive? And I talked with Dr. Benson Haver about mammograms. Since I've started to be public about my story, I've gotten a lot of people reach out to me. I've talked to a 31-year-old mom mm-hmm. who was breastfeeding when they found this. I've talked to sort of people in their 20s. And you know the stories of that are out there, the famous people like Olivia Munn and all this. These are young people. Why is this happening, especially in people that don't have the gene? It doesn't seem to be genetic. What are we doing to ourselves?
Yeah. So there's a lot of factors that go into that. I would say first and foremost, one of the things that I learned very early is that in patients that appear to have a genetic predisposition, it's about 20% of the patients we see. But of those 20%, only 10% have an identifiable gene. So it doesn't mean that it's not a genetic predisposition. We just don't know what gene we're necessarily looking for. So, and that's one of the reasons why risk assessment is really important. This isn't for cancer patients. This is for non-cancer patients. But if you have a family history, a significant family history, see somebody and have a risk assessment done, because it's entirely possible that outside of a known genetic predisposition, you're high risk and you should be screened in a different way. But in addition to these genetic predispositions that we may or may not know about, we know that there are other things happening, that environmental factors, we, you know, 80% of the cases we see are spontaneous. But I think too that there are just things that we don't know that are making these happen. But also too, we're much more open about these things and seeing them and these being diagnosed. I mean, if you look back years ago, these are, you didn't necessarily know it. One of the most poignant cases that I've ever had was a patient that was extremely young. She was BRCA positive and didn't know it because she had a family member that was diagnosed like generations back. They was diagnosed at an extremely young age and passed away, but nobody knew it was breast cancer. Mm. So it wasn't that the genetic history wasn't there. They just weren't aware of it because people didn't necessarily talk about it. And so we're kind of at this point in time where it's all coming to light and people are talking about it. It's not looked at as a stigma. So I think it's a combination of multiple things. Environment can be part of it too, but genetics is certainly there. And I do think that talking about it, bringing it to light so people aren't ashamed or don't think it's, you know, something that should be hidden is really important. And what you're doing, I think, is huge for that.
Well, I like that aspect of it, that we can talk about it. I mean, we're on a podcast talking about it, you know, and a long time ago, I don't think that would happen. So I think there's value here in the people that are going to be listening. I just know that all of my friends are looking for a way to protect themselves, be proactive. And a lot of them are doing all the right things. And sometimes, like it happened to me, it happens in between mammograms.
Yeah. I would say for all women, certainly, if you think you could be at high risk for whatever reason, family history, if you just have lumpy, bumpy breast, if something just doesn't feel right, talk to your PCP and see what they have to say. And if they are, you know, not certain, then find a breast specialist. I have no problem seeing somebody that's like, hey, I just want to know where I'm at, where I fall, and is this important? But certainly for the general population, mammograms at 40.
Okay. And I've gotten some messages from people who have listened to the story and they're like, I'm going to go get a mammogram. I'm like, great.
I think something else worth bringing up though, too, is if you feel something, don't assume it's okay. If you're not 40, just get it checked. I mean, I regularly see patients that have benign breast masses that are like, you know, I felt it. I've known it's there forever. And then all of a sudden it started growing. Like I will tell them, I love that you've been proactive. I love that you're here. But if you can tell anything or educate anyone, when you feel it initially, just come be seen. Don't wait. And oftentimes those are benign breast lesions, which are, you know, fine. We can manage those either by observation. Sometimes we have to remove them. But if you feel something, just ask.
Lloyd, yes. Jason, the new saying is feel something, say something.
Yeah, I get it. I think that's a great saying. And you know, what we heard, just a glimpse into your show, your podcast, Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way. I mean, you know, Jamie, I know this is going to help. You've already said it's helping people already, helping some of your friends say, listen, I need to get a mammogram. I need to go and, you know, be proactive.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's my goal. And, you know, even the people on the journey already starting their treatment, like I said, when I heard other people going through it, it helped me. So that is my hope, that this is helping some people out there as they listen. And episode 2 is everywhere you get podcasts. Just search Jamie Edmonds, or you could go to WJR's YouTube page.
Jamie, it's always great to hear you. You know, we're standing with you every step of the way, and we're encouraging everyone to keep you lifted in love and in support. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
God bless, Jamie.
Boy, I'm telling you, man, that's really encouraging.
It's cool that she's doing it too, because yes, the platform that she has, being on WJR, flagship radio station in Michigan, she's reaching millions of people.
And she's so used to interviewing others, and now she's the story. And you know, in journalism, we're always told you're not the story, you know, but she is the story this time, and we are with her 100%. Coming up, Richard Hudson. He's the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee. We'll speak with him next at 8:35 on JR Morning.
Stay here for All Talk with Kevin Dietz at 9. Now back to JR Morning with Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds on WJR, where Michigan comes to talk. Once again, in for Chris, here's Republican strategist Jason Rowe.
Good morning. This is Jason Rowe here co-hosting with Lloyd in the absence of Chris and Jamie. Our next guest is a friend of mine of over 20 years, the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee. That is the political arm of the House Republicans in Congress, Richard Hudson. Welcome, Richard.
Hey, Jason. Great to be with you.
You know, I was reminding myself when I was told I get to intro you as well that I might go look at your Wikipedia page, and it's hard to believe you are in your 7th term in Congress already. For listeners, we were chiefs of staff back on Capitol Hill 25 years ago, and Congressman Hudson has ascended to lead the House Republicans and helped win the majority again in 2024 and facing 2026. Right now, we got some headwinds, and here in Michigan, which is the center of the political universe, there's going to be over $1 billion spent. We got an open governor's race, attorney general, secretary of state, U.S. Senate, 4 or 5 congressional races. And by the way, while I have you, Congressman, WJR is the biggest radio station in Michigan. And so when you're spending all those NRCC dollars, this is a great place to do it. You can hit Ohio and Indiana as well. But talk a little bit about where we are in terms of holding the majority, but also what it looks like in Michigan and Michigan 7, 8, 10, 3, and maybe even 4.
Well, I appreciate that, Jason. Michigan is the center of the political universe this cycle. There's no question. And the House Republicans, we're on offense. We've got strong incumbents who are running hard. We've got strong recruits. And frankly, the Democrat Party brand is in free fall because the party just keeps moving further and further left, out of touch with working families in Michigan. You know, and to capitalize on that, the NRCC is investing earlier than we ever have in these races. And they're frankly going to, Michigan will decide whether President Trump has a governing majority for the next 2 years or not. You know, the Democrats, in most cases, are facing brutal political environment in these battleground districts after years of supporting higher taxes, open borders, inflation that's just made things unaffordable for families in Michigan. And they're, you know, the way I describe it in these primaries, they're trying to out-mandami each other, the race to the left to see who can be the most radical and extreme. And families in Michigan just are fed up with it. And so we've got candidates. We've got a fundraising advantage for the first time since I remember. And we've got a lot of political momentum right now. But every one of these races is going to require an all-hands-on-deck effort from grassroots volunteers, donors, local supporters. And so we've already started investing in this ground game so that we can do direct voter contact. You know, Michigan, again, you know, we're defending 3 seats, and I think we've got at least 2 pickup opportunities in Michigan. But every one of these districts is going to be very competitive. Margins are very tight. And, you know, but voters are, I think, are paying very close attention to who's actually addressing the issues that impact them and their families.
Richard, gas prices are rising again, people feeling the pressure at the pump. And when you hear concerns about affordability today, rent, groceries, fuel, do you think the voters separate that from broader political narratives about recovery?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, the way I look at it, Donald Trump and House Republicans are on a rescue mission to save this country. I mean, you think back just a few years ago when Democrats had complete control, they ran this country into the ditch. I mean, we had open borders, crime on the rise. We had inflation at record highs, gas prices at record highs. I mean, I think the national average is something like $5.65 a gallon for gasoline. And under President Trump, we're making real progress. We're on a rescue mission, but we're not done yet. So a lot of families are still feeling the pinch. You know, we were able to get gas prices down under $3 a gallon. Now with the Iran war, we've seen them spike up to as much as $4.20. So it's still nowhere near where it was when Democrats were in charge, when, you know, they raised gas prices on purpose because they wanted to push us all to electric vehicles. You know, and what we're dealing with today is, you know, we had a crazy religious zealot oligarch in Iran who wanted a nuclear weapon, not so they could have it, but so they could use it. And we've had a lot of presidents give lip service. This president had the courage to go in and stop them. Thank goodness he did. And there is a little bit of economic turmoil created by that. But it's, I think most voters understand that that's short term, that's, you know, is going to come to an end at some point. And because of the policies that we've put in place, supported by people like Tom Barrett, Bill Huizenga, you know, we have put this country on a path to very low gas, very low energy costs. So the future is very bright. So that's our message to the voters is, look, you got a choice. We can go back to when the Democrats were in charge and we couldn't afford anything, or you can let us continue this rescue mission to get the country in the right place.
Well, and you make some good points. You know, take immigration, for instance. You know, we had the Biden administration, which let 10 to 15 million people into the country illegally. And I lived in San Diego along the San Diego-Tijuana border. I've seen firsthand the impact, but we were told for decades that you can't do anything about it. and all of a sudden Donald Trump came in and did something about it, and there is no illegal immigration on the southern border. It slowed the flow of fentanyl into our communities. It's impacted the human trafficking crisis that happens along the Mexican border. But then also, when you look at crime nationally, we're at a 125-year low in the homicide rate in America. That's a pretty extraordinary number. But you made another good point, and that is fundraising. I would say in the last decade, our candidate quality is much better than it's been in a long time, whereas the Democrats don't have quite the candidate quality, or at least electable candidates. And then fundraising, and whether it's the candidates or it's the national party committees or the super PACs, Republicans seem to be outperforming Democrats in every single category. And then you have this historic situation in which the sitting president of the United States has $350 million available to him going in to help protect our majorities. And then you have all the changes in the redistricting. When you look at all of the things going our way right now, what do you see as the biggest impediments to us holding the House and even expanding in the Senate?
Well, I agree with everything you said, Jason. I think you're right on the money. I think going back to why are we leading in fundraising, why do we have better candidates? I think it's because fundamentally we are focused on the needs of everyday Americans, the middle class, and the Democrats are way off in left field. I think they've forgotten the working families in this country. Their party is the elites, and they seem to be focused on how can they help illegal immigrants and how can they give away things for free? Well, you know, if you work for a living, you know nothing's free. Somebody's got to pay the bill. And so I just think the Democrat Party's completely lost its way. You know, it's not the party of my grandfather, who was a proud Democrat, but, you know, he also voted for Ronald Reagan, Locke Faircloth, Jesse Helms. You know, he was a conservative. There was room for conservatives in the Democrat Party. Today, I mean, you look at these primaries, like in the 7th District, I mean, you got two millionaires who've moved into the district being propped up by dark money. You've got the one guy from the district, William Lawrence, is a Bernie Sanders, Zohran Mamdani disciple. They're all racing to see who can be the most radical leftist to win that primary. But it's got, you know, families in Michigan are just scratching their head thinking, yeah, you know, these folks, how could they represent me? They, mm-hmm. you know, I don't even know what planet they're from.
Richard Hudson, chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee. It's a pleasure having you on this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
All right. Have a good one.
Thanks, Richard.
Coming up, Monday Munchies is what Jason has been waiting for all morning long. That's why he's still here, because he's waiting for Monday Munchies. We'll be talking about Monday Munchies and a sweet deal with them as well next on JR Morning. Welcome back to JR Morning. It is a Monday, and on Monday, there are always Monday Munchies. And my co-host this morning, Jason Rowe, I got him to stay around this morning because he was waiting for Monday Munchies. And today we have the executive chef, Scott Brazil, of Chicane, located in Plymouth. Scott, good to see you, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Yes. tell us about the restaurant. I mean, it's really described as a kind of upscale social lounge, but it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Yes, we are a little upscale, but also, you know, we're a neighborhood joint in Old Village, Plymouth, right on the railroad tracks there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something for everybody. You know, yes, we have high-end wood-fired grilled steaks. We also have scratch-made pastas, all made in-house. And then, you know, we got burger and some sandwiches. So something for everybody. You can come multiple times a week and, you know, not be crushed.
I was looking online at your images of your space. It really looks like a beautiful restaurant. I'm looking forward to it, and just hearing you describe the menu is enticing. How long you been there?
The restaurant's been open. We started February last year, so just a year and a couple months, really. The owner, Don Soonan, is a local Plymouth native, 50-some years in Plymouth. He's done pretty much everything around town. He's almost the honorary mayor. He put a lot of money and opulent finishes into the restaurant, you know, real high-end fixtures. But once again, you know, like, you go in there, you feel at home, it's comfortable, it's laid back, it's not pretentious feeling or anything like that. You know, no white tablecloths and mm-hmm. all of that business. And then he used to own Center Stage, if any of you guys remember Center Stage,
So
the restaurant also features live music Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, really killer sound system. So, yeah, it's got a little bit of everything.
I know where I'm going this weekend.
And talk about your career path. This, you know.
Yeah, I've had an interesting path. I'm a local guy, you know, so grew up in Plymouth, went to high school in Plymouth. So moved out to West, went to pastry school, jumped around, did some pastry gigs, worked my way through some kitchens into all of a sudden the executive chef position, ended up at Ford Field for a few seasons.
Oh,
rest in peace, my buddy Joe Nader. He was the executive chef over there, if you guys remember Joe. And then Don reached out. He was opening the restaurant here in Plymouth and, hit it off right from the get. We both had similar vision of what we'd like to do there and kind of a legacy project, you know, me being the hometown guy.
Sure.
You know, 30 years in the business plus, and then coming back to Plymouth, now opening this really cool restaurant. So, yeah, it's a pretty cool story, really.
Mm-hmm. What's the signature item on your menu?
Oh, signature item? Well, wood-fired grill, so steaks are absolutely dynamite. You know, something about grilling over live fire.
Oh, man.
The smokiness of the wood. We use all Michigan hardwood, local company, kiln dried, so it's real hot. And then I would say our pastas are probably, which is what I brought one of you guys today, one of our signature pasta dishes. It's a gnocchi sardi. It's a semolina and water dough. We use an extruder. To make that, it's not your typical potato, fluffy, pillowy ricotta. It's more like a pasta noodle.
Okay.
Cream, house-made chicken sausage. It's got spinach, sun-dried tomatoes, a little bit of garlic, Parmesan cheese. Beauty dish. Sell a ton of them every weekend. And then mortadella sandwich. So, once again, kind of featuring the stuff that's maybe more approachable and maybe... you know, less expensive.
Sure.
Mortadella sandwich, rosemary focaccia, all the breads made in-house. Fig jam, mortadella, arugula, burrata, and then basil pesto on top.
Getting very hungry.
Oh, yeah, man.
It's killer.
So now, and I know you're the chef, but, you know, when you have a, you know, wood-fired menu, you got to have a good drink to go along with that as well. Can you kind of tell us about that?
I'm an old-fashioned guy, big bourbon lover.
Okay.
We do a really nice, we have a really nice signature old-fashioned.
Okay.
The, you know, you're pushing me to remember talk about some stuff I don't know a ton about.
That's okay.
We got a killer bar program.
Sure.
We have a really great couple bartenders that knock it out of the park. Beauty drinks, beauty cocktails, high-end stuff to stuff, once again, that's approachable.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
And tell us once again where you're located and your hours and all of that.
Yeah, of course. 885 Starkweather in Old Village, Plymouth. The name of the restaurant, Chicane. Open Tuesday and through Sunday. We offer a Sunday brunch. Most... killer happy hour you can get around right now. Half off appetizers, 4 to 6. Half off wine on Wednesday. Thursday's dollar oysters. I mean, we got a killer program going on over there.
Wow.
Yeah, get there early. It's busy. So,
I'm interested in all of that, especially at Sunday brunch. I'm always looking for a good brunch place on Sunday.
Yeah, you know, also, you know, looking for an event. We have a 120 seat event space attached to the building as well. So, hosting the ACF Michigan Chef de Cuisine Chefs meeting tonight at the restaurant as well.
Well, Executive Chef Scott Brazil, thank you for stopping by and being part of Monday Munchies. Chicane, located in Plymouth. Go check them out. Thank
Gentlemen,
you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jason Rowe.
Yes, sir.
Good to see you.
Yeah,
it was so nice. Let's do it twice, tomorrow.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, let's do it. All talk next on 760 WJR.